Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Greg Dalton, CEO of the Commonwealth Club. Our distinguished guest today is Elizabeth Colbert, a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine and author of Field Notes from Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Field Notes is based on a three-part series Ms. Colbert wrote last year for the New Yorker, chronicling the effects of climate changes on our world today and on civilizations throughout history. She traveled to the far reaches of Alaska, Greenland, and elsewhere to witness dramatic changes in the Earth's atmosphere, from ice that is melting for the first time in thousands of years to a now extinct toad in the forests of Costa Rica. She eloquently describes how global warming is impacting every person in every continent in the delicate web of life. Before joining the New Yorker in 1999, she was a reporter for the New York Times. Please welcome Elizabeth Colbert.
Thanks very much, Greg, for that introduction. And also, thanks very much for inviting me. I'm very pleased to have a chance to speak at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. You know, as an East Coaster, I have to confess that I used to be a bit of a Commonwealth Club skeptic. I kept hearing about this place on the radio, but no one I knew actually belonged. And how could I be sure that it was for real? People kept telling me that some of these things are just a creation of NPR, a hoax perpetrated by the liberal media to raise needless fears. But now that I'm here, I see that it's true, that the Commonwealth Club really does exist, and it's happening right now. As you know, I'm here to talk to you tonight about global warming. I first started to report on this topic a little more than 2 years ago, in the spring of 2004, when I set out to write what would eventually become a series of articles for The New Yorker. And initially, this meant talking to lots of people, obviously to lots of scientists, but also to Inupiat hunters and politicians and archaeologists and eventually people in New Orleans whose houses had filled with 10 feet of water during Hurricane Katrina. And in the process, I got to travel to some extraordinary places, including the town of Dead Horse on the north slope of Alaska, and a research station called Swiss Camp on the top of the Greenland ice sheet, where, incidentally, I was assigned to sleep in a tent of the same sort used by Robert Scott on his ill-fated expedition to the South Pole. And finally, I tried to pull together what I had seen and heard into a series of articles that people waiting in their dentist's office to have their teeth cleaned, or commuting home to Brooklyn on the IRT might want to read. And if it sounds like a crazy enterprise, then I have to say it often felt like a crazy enterprise. And in the course of my reporting, I found that I kept bumping up against two apparently contradictory phenomena, or you might say themes. And the first of these is the extraordinary power of modern science. Such is the state of climate research today. We now have at our disposal satellite measurements, general circulation models, supercomputers, and detailed ice core records going back more than 500,000 years. That to a remarkable degree, we can now look into the future and know where we are headed. And the second is the impotence of this very same science. Decisions now being made by corporations, by governments, and by individuals in this country and around the globe will determine the state of the planet certainly a century from now, probably a millennium from now, and quite possibly will have consequences that persist for tens of thousands, even millions of years. For the most part, these decisions are being made in direct contradiction to what science is telling us. We look, but we refuse to see. This is, in its own way, a classic narrative pattern, not so much for journalism, of course, as for tragedy. I thought it might be helpful to start out tonight with what you might call a brief history of global warming, which, as an idea at least, is at this point more than a century old. And the initial critical insight dates all the way back to the middle of the 19th century. And at that time, climate was a scientific preoccupation, even, you could say, an obsession. Louis Agassiz published his theory of the ice ages in 1840, and as you can imagine, it created a great sensation. "Your work on glaciers has filled me with admiration," Charles Darwin wrote to Agassiz after reading his Etude sur les glaciers. But what could have caused the advance and retreat of the ice sheets? In the late 1850s, an Irish physicist named John Tyndall got the idea of testing various gases in the air to see how they absorb and transmit radiation. And to this end, he built the world's first ratio spectrophotometer, a machine that engravings show to have been an almost Rube Goldberg-esque collection of pipes and tubes connected to a galvanometer. And when Tyndall used his machine to test the most common gases in the atmosphere, which are nitrogen and oxygen, he found that they were fully transparent, which is to say they allowed both visible and infrared radiation to pass freely. But other gases were not. CO2 and, just as significantly, water vapor were, he discovered, transparent in the visible part of the spectrum, but partly opaque in the infrared. Tyndall was quick to appreciate the implications of his discovery for climate. The selectively transparent gases, he theorized, were largely responsible for determining the planet's temperature. And Tyndall was an extremely popular public lecturer, a fact that testifies both to his own considerable skills as a speaker and also to the intellectual interests of the Victorian middle class. And many of his lectures were eventually collected and published. And in one of these lectures, Tyndall, who wrote in this sort of luxuriant Victorian style, compared the impact of these selectively transparent gases to that of a dam built across a river. And I've always liked this image. And he writes, "Just as a dam causes a local deepening of the stream, so our atmosphere, thrown as a barrier across the terrestrial rays, produces a local heightening of the temperature at the Earth's surface." And the phenomenon that Tyndall identified is what's now referred to as the natural greenhouse effect. And the natural greenhouse effect is not, and since Tyndall's day, really hasn't been at all controversial. It's described in any basic earth science textbook because, as Tyndall recognized all the way back in the mid-19th century, it is crucial to life on Earth as we know it. And global warming is sometimes referred to as the enhanced greenhouse effect, and it's a function of the same basic geophysical principles. The Earth is constantly receiving energy from the sun, mostly in the form of visible light, and at the same time, it's constantly emitting energy back out to space, mostly in the form of infrared radiation or heat. And in order for the planet to be in equilibrium, which is to say neither cooling up nor either heating up nor cooling down, then the amount of energy flowing in and the amount of energy flowing out have to be equivalent. And there's a sort of thought experiment that is often used to explain this principle, and it goes like this. Imagine a world without greenhouse gases, a world more like, say, the moon. And in that purely hypothetical case, it's pretty easy, using a law that's known as the Stefan-Boltzmann law, which was also worked out in the 19th century, to calculate how warm the planet would have to be to radiate back out to space the same amount of energy it's getting from the sun, which, if you average it out over all latitudes and all seasons, comes to about 235 watts per square meter. And when you do the math, which I'm not going to do, I probably couldn't do it, but the equilibrium temperature of a greenhouse gas-free Earth turns out to be 0 degrees Fahrenheit. And here I'm talking about average global temperatures. And so at 0 degrees, the planet would be, if not necessarily devoid of life, then I think we can all agree, an extremely uncomfortable place. And to use Tyndall's Victorian language once again, if the heat-trapping gases were removed from the Earth's atmosphere for a single day, the warmth of our fields and gardens would pour itself unrequited into space, and the sun would rise upon an island held fast in the iron grip of frost. At the time that Tyndall was doing his experiments, which was the late 1850s, industrialization was, of course, already in full swing. Henry Bessemer had just invented the Bessemer process for mass-producing steel. The Central Pacific and Union Pacific railroads were working their way towards their eventual union in Promontory Summit, Utah. and the world's first petroleum refinery was about to be built in Titusville, Pennsylvania. Tyndall certainly understood that burning fossil fuels produce CO2. But while he speculated about the effects of changing greenhouse gas levels on climate history, he never, as far as we know, went so far as to consider how these changes might affect the climate future. And that next step was taken by a Swedish chemist named Svante Arrhenius. And Arrhenius wondered what would happen to the Earth's temperature if CO2 levels were halved, and also if they were doubled. And mainly he seems to have asked these questions because he was also interested in what could have caused the ice ages. And the questions turned out to be easy to ask, but very difficult to answer, in part because when you change CO2 levels, you also change a lot of other things, like how much moisture the air can hold, and water vapor, as I mentioned earlier, is also a greenhouse gas. And Arrhenius would eventually go on to win the Nobel Prize for an unrelated discovery, his discovery of electrolytic dissociation. And he began his calculations on Christmas Eve 1894, or at least so he reported. He had actually just recently been ditched by his wife, so perhaps he had nothing better to do. But he routinely worked on these calculations, once again, self-reportedly, for 14 hours a day. And he was not finished for almost a year. And drawing the connection that Tyndall had failed to make, Arrhenius predicted that industrialization would inevitably lead to a warmer world. In fact, the warming that he predicted for doubled CO2 turns out to be eerily close to what is now predicted by the most sophisticated computer models. Arrhenius estimated that the temperature increase would be between 9 and 11 degrees Fahrenheit, and today climate modelers put the equilibrium warming associated with doubled CO2 at a range between 3.5 and 7 degrees Fahrenheit. But Arrhenius also missed what now seems to us the really significance of his own findings, and that's for a couple of reasons. First off, he was a chemist and not a biologist or a geologist, and he doesn't seem to have appreciated how warming of the magnitude he was projecting would affect things like ecosystems or rainfall patterns or disease vectors. And in fact, perhaps because he was Swedish, he basically took it for granted that a warmer world would simply be a better world. And he was also, Arrhenius was also an extremely popular writer. He wrote some very popular works of popular science, that were translated into English pretty quickly. And in one of those, he wrote, by the influence of the increasing percentage of carbonic acid in the atmosphere, that's carbonic acid is how they used to refer to CO2, we may hope to enjoy ages with more equable and better climates, especially as regards the colder regions of the Earth. And second, Arrhenius got the timing wrong. He thought that the oceans would act basically like a huge sponge and that they would soak up virtually all of the CO2 that industrialization could produce. And at one point, he predicted that it would take 3,000 years of coal burning to double atmospheric carbon. And Arrhenius died in 1927, and after that, interest in climate change dropped off. Most scientists continued to believe that CO2 levels were nothing to worry about, and that if they were rising at all, they were rising only very, very slowly. And then in the mid-1950s, for no particularly good reason, a young chemist named Charles David Keeling, who was doing a postdoc here in California at Caltech, decided to work out a new and more precise way of measuring atmospheric CO2. And later he would explain this decision by saying he was having fun trying to assemble the necessary equipment. And in 1958, David Keeling convinced the U.S. Weather Bureau to start using his technique to monitor CO2 at its new observatory, 11,000 feet above sea level, on the flank of Mauna Loa on the island of Hawaii. And these same CO2 measurements have been taken at Mauna Loa nearly continuously ever since 1958. And the results are known as the Keeling Curve, and they may well be the most widely reprinted set of natural science data ever collected. And if you have ever seen the Keeling Curve, it's presented in the form of a graph, and it looks like the edge of a saw that is being held up at a tilt. And each tooth corresponds to a single year. And in the summer, when the forests of the Northern Hemisphere put out their leaves and start taking up CO2 for photosynthesis, then the atmospheric concentrations go down. And when those forests go dormant in the winter, atmospheric CO2 goes up again. And the tilt, meanwhile, corresponds to the rising annual mean. And the first full year that CO2 levels were recorded at Mauna Loa was 1959. And that year, the mean stood at 316 parts per million. By the following year, it had reached 317 parts per million, and that already prompted Keeling to propose that the reigning assumption about CO2 absorption by the oceans might be wrong. By 1970, the CO2 level had reached 325 parts per million, and by 1990, it was up to 354 parts per million. In the spring of 2005, the CO2 level stood at 378 parts per million, and by this spring, it had jumped to 381 parts per million, and that was a near-record increase. And thanks to the work of scientists who have drilled these extraordinary ice cores in Greenland and on Antarctica, we can now reconstruct CO2 levels from pre-industrial times because tiny bubbles of air get trapped in the ice and they provide a year-by-year inventory of the atmosphere for us. And so we now know that for the 10,000 years prior to the Industrial Revolution, CO2 levels hovered right around 280 parts per million. So at the current rate, we are on track to reach double that level by around the year 2050, which is to say roughly 2,800 years ahead of Arrhenius' prediction. Now, when scientists realized that CO2 levels were rising 10 or 20 times faster than had been expected, they went back to Arrhenius' calculations, this time, of course, with the help of computers. And at that point in the mid-1970s, the leader of NASA's climate modeling team was, and in fact still is, a physicist named James Hansen. And you've probably heard of James Hansen. He recently made a lot of news by accusing the Bush administration of trying to shut him up. And by 1981, Hansen had gained enough confidence in his model to predict that carbon dioxide warming should emerge from the noise of natural climate variability around the year 2000. And give or take a year or two, that is really exactly what has happened. According to NASA, 2005 was the warmest year on record, and it is very closely followed by 1998, which is really in a statistical dead heat, if you can forgive the expression, and then by 2002, 2003, and 2004. So you can tell that four of the warmest years on record have occurred, you know, just in the last 5 years. And since, as Hansen noted, climate is inherently noisy, it's hard to say exactly when in this sequence natural climate variability could be ruled out as the sole cause. But to give you a sense of the scientific community's view on this question, the American Geophysical Union decided that the matter had been settled in 2003. And that year, at its annual meeting, which I believe is always held here in San Francisco, it issued a consensus statement asserting natural influences cannot explain the rapid increase in global near-surface temperatures. Now, this story that I've told to this point is, in one sense, a classic narrative of scientific triumph. People make discoveries, some of them are inadvertent, other people build on them, and eventually the theory and the evidence line up and the truth will out. We now spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year on climate research. In fact, there may well be more people studying global warming here in the state of California today than there were scientists of any sort worldwide when John Tyndall was around. But at the same time, if what you focus on is not the progress of science as an isolated intellectual exercise, but the role of science in a modern society, then it is a pretty devastating tale of failure. I actually spoke to David Keeling about a year and a half ago, and as it happened, it was just a few months before he died. And he told me that by the mid-1970s, basically, we knew all we needed to know that we needed to take action. But if you look at what has happened here in the U.S., which is supposedly the world's most technologically advanced nation, since that point, then for all intents and purposes, all of the intervening studies and expeditions and model runs might as well not have existed. Take, for example, fuel efficiency. In the U.S., the fuel efficiency of the average new passenger vehicle was increasing rapidly in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And then what happened? SUVs were introduced. In 1985, SUVs accounted for 2% of new vehicles sold in the U.S. Today, they account for about 25%. The average new car purchased today weighs about 4,100 pounds, which is up from 3,200 pounds in the early 80s. And fuel efficiency of the American fleet actually peaked about 20 years ago and since then has declined slowly. Meanwhile, the average size of a newly constructed home went from 1,500 square feet in 1970 to almost 2,400 square feet in 2004. And not surprisingly, CO2 emissions in the U.S. have risen apace from 5.8 billion metric tons of CO2 in 1980 to 6.8 billion metric tons last year. Meanwhile, global warming, once a purely prospective concern, is now palpably affecting people's lives. And when I set off in the spring of 2004 on a tour of what you might call global warming hotspots, the first place I visited was an Inupiat village named Shishmaref. And Shishmaref sits on a tiny island off the Stewart Peninsula. And it used to be protected by the sea ice, which acted sort of the way a tarp would on a pool, preventing the surface of the sea from getting roiled up. And now the sea ice comes in later and later, and Shishmaref just gets pummeled by false storms, and the whole island is basically disappearing. So a couple of years ago, the people of Shishmaref voted to move the whole village onto the mainland. But this is an extremely expensive proposition. It's estimated it would cost $180 million. So at this point, they are still there. The experiences of the people in Shishmaref turn out to be representative of what's going on all around the Arctic at the edge of the ice cap. Satellite measurements of the perennial Arctic sea ice, and that sea ice that persists year-round, show that its extent has declined dramatically in recent years. And 2005 was a record melt year. At the end of the melt season, which is in late September, the extent of the sea ice was the lowest ever measured. And the loss in just the last 25 years amounts to 500,000 square miles, or, as it's often said, an area twice the size of Texas. And this loss is a symptom of global warming, but it's also a cause. And this leads to the whole issue of feedbacks. Ice, particularly sea ice, which has a very clean white surface, is highly reflective. It reflects something like 80% of the sunlight that hits it. And this has a huge effect on the climate because that energy isn't being absorbed. But when you convert that ice to water, water is an extremely bad reflector, and it just soaks up that energy. And that causes more melt, which leads to more heat absorption, and so on. And this feedback is one of the reasons that the Arctic is heating up so quickly. And in fact, there are recently have been projections that the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free in summertime by the middle of this century. And some people say that it could be ice-free before that. Now, another impact of a warming that you're starting to see is thawing permafrost. And I took a ride through the interior of Alaska with a great guy, a permafrost expert named Vladimir Romanovsky. And we started out in Fairbanks, and we drove all the way up to the North Slope. And when permafrost starts to thaw, and a lot of it around Fairbanks is thawing, and even a lot of it up near the North Slope is starting to get near the thawing point, it can just basically give way, like a floorboard that has rotted. And the trees that are growing on top of thawing permafrost start to list over as if they were tipsy, and you get this phenomenon, which is familiar to everyone in Alaska, of a drunken forest, it's called. And like melting sea ice, thawing permafrost is both a symptom of global warming and potentially a cause of more of it. And that's because permafrost is so cold, really, by definition, it's frozen, and so the plants that grow on top of it do not fully decompose when they die. So there's a tremendous amount of stored carbon in the permafrost, by some estimates as much as 450 billion metric tons. And as the permafrost starts to warm up, the carbon that's stored in it is likely to be released back into the air. And Romanovsky put it to me this way, it's like a ready-to-use mix, just a little heat, and it will start cooking. Another place that I visited was the town of Ilulissat in western Greenland. This is a town that sits at the edge of an ice stream known as the Jakobshavn Isbrae, and this ice stream just pushes these huge icebergs into the bay, and it's likely that this is the source of the iceberg that sunk the Titanic. And people who live there will tell you that the icebergs have gotten smaller and that they break up more easily, and this information is confirmed by all sorts of measurements now taken. And what these show is that the ice stream is moving faster and that its height is dropping, and that its calving front is moving farther and farther inland. It's very strange the last few years, and a Ilulissat town councilman told me, you can see a lot of strange changes. Now, all the places that I've mentioned so far are in the Arctic, and that's no coincidence because a lot of the impacts of global warming are most noticeable in the far north, where, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at things, not many people live. And this effect is sometimes called the polar amplification, and it was also predicted by early climate models 30 years ago. And so what about closer to home? Well, I live in New England, and there the changes are more subtle, but they're definitely measurable. Spring flowering dates have advanced by about a week. Frogs are mating earlier. Snow cover is declining. And we get more of our rainfall in these very heavy precipitation events of 2 inches or more in 24 hours. Here in California, you're seeing declining spring snowpack and earlier spring runoff, both developments that have unfortunate implications for water availability in summer. And all of these effects were also predicted. Another predicted effect of global warming is more intense hurricanes, which we certainly seem to have seen this past year. 2005 broke just about every hurricane record you can name. Now, as clear as they are, the changes that we're seeing are also, in a certain sense, misleading. And that is because the climate operates on an enormous time lag. And this lag, in large part, is a function of the tremendous amount of energy required to heat up the oceans and also to melt ice. And Jim Hansen, whom I mentioned before, and his group at NASA have calculated that the warming the Earth has experienced so far is only about half of what's needed to bring the planet back into energy balance. And that means that even if CO2 concentrations could magically be held at today's level, and that would require some pretty heavy-duty magic, the planet would still continue to heat up until it reached a new equilibrium. So where are we headed? Well, it's pretty clear that we are steering into some extremely dangerous territory. In 1999, scientists completed an analysis of an Antarctic ice core which was extracted at a Russian station called Vostok, which is right near the South Geomagnetic Pole. In addition to providing data about CO2 levels, ice cores can also give you a very detailed record of temperature going back in time due to changes in the isotopic composition of the ice. And the Vostok record comprises 420,000 years, which is four glacial cycles. And what it shows is that temperature and CO2 have been varying in tandem for that entire time. During glacial periods, CO2 levels were low, and during interglacials, they have always been higher. And what is remarkable, or if you prefer, really actually terrifying about the Vostok record, is that it shows we are already off the charts in terms of CO2. Over the last 420,000 years, there's not a single point when CO2 levels ever got above 300 parts per million. And as I mentioned before, we are now at 381. And it is believed that the last time carbon dioxide levels were comparable to today's was 3.5 million years ago, during what's known as the mid-Pliocene warm period, which is obviously a long time before modern humans evolved. And it is likely that CO2 levels have not been significantly higher than they are today since the Eocene some 50 million years ago. Now, recently there has been a lot of discussion about whether we are approaching some kind of threshold, or to use the term so much in vogue these days, tipping point with regard to the climate. And what that really means is, are we near some point where the positive feedbacks become so overwhelming that the system basically gets away from us and there's no way to prevent catastrophe? And there are many possible candidates for catastrophic climate change, unfortunately. And an exemplary one that is often held up is melting the Greenland ice sheet. And the Greenland ice sheet holds enough water to raise global sea levels by more than 15 feet. And we know that there is increasing melt on the surface of the ice sheet, and it appears that this water doesn't just sit on the surface of the ice sheet, it percolates down, causing the whole thing to start flowing faster. And scientists who work in Greenland will tell you that they are seeing the place change at a rate that is an order of magnitude greater than they were taught to believe was even possible. And since, as I mentioned before, the climate operates on a significant time lag, the threshold for catastrophic change is crossed long before disaster actually occurs. It is reached as soon as you get enough greenhouse gases in the air to produce a temperature rise whose consequences for the planet, and more specifically for humans, will be calamity. And in terms of something like melting the Greenland ice sheet, that threshold could be 400 parts per million of CO2, which we will get to sometime in the next decade, or it could be 500 parts per million, which we'll reach by mid-century, or to be very frank with you, it could be 380 parts per million, which we reached last year. We don't know exactly what that threshold is. All we know is that we can't wait for that certainty, if we are to avoid crossing it. Now, I'm about to wrap up here, and that means that it is time for me to shift registers. I've presented you with all of the very scary facts and figures, and now it's time for me to explain how, if we pull together, we can stave off this disaster. And there certainly is a great deal that we can do. On an individual level, there are all sorts of choices that we make every day that affect our emissions, from the kinds of cars we drive, to how much we drive, to the kind of light bulbs we use. On a state level, there's a tremendous amount that can be done. Here in California, just to name one example, you have the Clean Car Act, which, if you can beat back the challenge from the auto industry, would dramatically affect emissions, and not just here in this state, but because of California's market power, probably across the whole country. And on a federal level, there is probably almost no limit to what we could accomplish if, for example, we were willing to impose a serious cap on carbon emissions. So if global warming were treated as a truly urgent national priority, like, say, the war in Iraq, then substantial progress could clearly be made. But while a turn to this kind of hortatory message would be reassuring, I really don't want to end that way. Instead, I'm going to throw it back to you with a question. And the question is, why haven't we taken global warming more seriously? And I hope that I have impressed upon you tonight that it is not because the science is in any way equivocal. The basic physics of global warming have been understood for more than a century now. Fully 25 years ago, the changes that we are now seeing all over the world were predicted by climate modelers. Any journalist or government official or helpful neighbor who tells you that he or she remains skeptical about the connection between human activity and climate change is someone who either hasn't really looked at the evidence, or is on the payroll of an oil company, or most likely is just too self-protective to face the facts. And by self-protective, I don't mean selfish merely in the narrow sense of someone who only cares about him or herself. I mean someone who is too sentimental, or maybe too anxious, or maybe too guilt-ridden to acknowledge what is really going on here, which is that we are creating enormous, quite possibly insuperable, difficulties for our children and grandchildren for what is, in the end, no very good reason. We, as Americans, lead lives of unprecedented comfort and privilege. More than any other nation, we, as a consequence, are in a position to do something. Global warming is obviously a technological problem, but it is finally an ethical one. With knowledge comes certain responsibilities, and it is these responsibilities that, as a society and also as individuals, we have been running away from. Thanks very much.
Our thanks to Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. We have a number of questions, so let us begin. I'd like to start with leadership. A couple of questions here about how to get President Bush to recognize and his administration the dangers of global warming, and also which politicians, if any, have embraced and shown leadership on the fight against global warming.
Well, how you get the Bush administration to pay attention to global warming is a challenge that I have to confess is beyond me. They are spending, you know, billions of dollars every year. They will, in fact, proudly tell you that they're spending billions of dollars every year on climate research. But when the results come in, they are ignored. So I don't know how you get their attention on this issue. In terms of people who have shown leadership, well, obviously, there was Al Gore, who has a new movie coming out on the topic, and look what happened to him. Also, John McCain has shown leadership on this issue. He has a bill in Congress that he insists is going to bring up again, which would set a cap on carbon emissions, and there would be established sort of a cap-and-trade system so that, you know, there would be a cap, and this would be all the CO2 we could emit in this country, a federal cap. And it's a pretty good bill. and it has now failed twice, and I believe it will fail a third time this spring. But he is also someone who has shown leadership on this issue. So it is not a partisan issue. It just hasn't really gotten up to the White House yet.
Then if politicians are not going to lead the charge, then what other organizations do you think are going to sort of be the driving force of change?
Well, I think it is actually going to be, state and local governments, and there is a lot going on. As people, you all know, who live in California, there's a lot going on in the state level. In New England, there's a regional compact of northeastern states to limit power plant emissions. And all these things are designed. They will not solve the problem. They will make a difference, but we really do need, national and, indeed, global action to actually deal with this problem. But every time, a state takes action, it does make a difference because people in Washington pay attention to what happens at the state level. So I think that at this point, is probably our best hope.
Another question here about individual change and behavioral change, and this person says, given that my colleagues can barely manage to recycle cans, plastic, and paper properly, how will we get them to change other personal habits that were required for the kind of change you're talking about?
Well, I think that, realistically, I strongly urge everyone, to make personal changes. But I think that people will make changes when, it's economically in their economic interest. And that is why we need, some kind of a cap or some kind of a tax that makes the cost of emitting carbon, which we are now all bearing, it's a classic kind of tragedy of the commons situation, something, that the emitter bears. And that is, once again, all of us. I mean, it would be an increase in our electric bills, it would be an increase in gas prices, all of those things, those are the big activities where we all emit carbon. So when it becomes more costly, we will emit less. And I think that's, unfortunately, pretty basic. I can't think of another way we're going to be able to deal with this problem.
One question has here, even if CO2 emissions stay the same, the Earth would continue to warm, and by what you're saying is it's continued to rise, so there's a certain sense of resignation here that we're kind of cooked, really.
Well, I think there should be the absolute opposite of a sense of resignation. We are talking about the difference between, another half a degree or a degree in the system, roughly what we've already experienced. We have already experienced warming on the planet, and, most people are probably aware of that in some sense. Certainly, people who have been around a while, as I have. But we are talking about the difference between changes that are probably ones we can accommodate, and we're talking about potential catastrophe. And that is really true. There's just no way around that. You have global sea levels, rising 16 feet, and I think that everyone could agree that that's a pretty catastrophic impact. And there are lots of other possibilities. There's tremendous drought in the center of this country, which, makes the breadbasket of the U.S. no longer a place where you can grow wheat or grow corn. So there are all sorts of possibilities here, and we are talking about that. Some of these things in the lifetime of our children, potentially even in our own lifetime, certainly potentially in the lifetime of our children. So if we care, about the world that our kids will inherit, then we can't be resigned. We have to be, absolutely motivated to try to do something. And not tomorrow, but really, yesterday.
We do have some questions from questioners or, say, skeptics in the audience. And one is that many experts state that the number of hurricanes have not increased in recent years. Do you have any specific data to prove that the actual number of hurricanes has increased?
We're not talking about the number of hurricanes. We're talking about the intensity of hurricanes. And there are two very good papers which I could give people the references to. I don't have them off the top of my head. One was in Nature and one was in Science, and they came out coincidentally right around the time of Katrina. And they showed that the proportion of hurricanes reaching Category 4 and 5 status has risen dramatically in the last 30 years, just in line with rising sea surface temperatures, which is what you would predict would happen as sea surface temperatures rise. So we are not necessarily talking about more hurricanes. We're talking about the hurricanes that there are being more intense. And there is very good evidence of that.
This person is, I guess you could say, sort of an optimistic skeptic who says that human beings can live in just about any environment. We're a very adaptable species. Can't we just adapt to radical change, environmental change?
Well, I mean, you know, great. I think that the thing that, unfortunately, you have to keep in mind is there are 6 billion of us on the planet. Actually, more, maybe 6.5 billion of us. So I don't know that anyone's, you know, predicting the demise of the human species. Doubtless, you know, some species, some humans, you know, will carry on. But we got to 6.5 billion people with the weather patterns we have now, and the monsoon patterns we have now, and the rainfall patterns we have now, and the coastlines we have now. And when you change that dramatically, you have to imagine a lot of other things changing, including, you know, geopolitical things. I mean, it's extremely geopolitically destabilizing. So the notion that, you know, we're all just going to adapt, and I should also add that the climate, if CO2 levels in the atmosphere keep rising, you don't get one climate. You don't get a climate, you know, a new climate that sort of settles down and, oh, well, we will, you know, adjust to this new climate. You get a climate that is always changing. So I think it's extremely difficult to imagine how 6.5 billion people, you know, heading towards 9 billion people, if you look at population projections, are going to simply adapt to that.
It's the ultimate Darwinian scenario, perhaps. What do you say to experts who are convinced that recent warming trends are simply the world warming after a mini ice age? And what do you say to people who say that temperatures are actually cooler now than pre-1970 and that global warming is not a major threat?
I say they're nuts. You know, the instrumental record is absolutely clear that we are not cooler than we were in 1970, and you can, you know, go on the web and find, you know, U.S. government documents on the EPA website to show you that. In terms of the notion that we are coming out of the little ice age, I really defy someone to find a climate scientist at this point who will say that all the warming we have seen over the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years is just coming out of a little ice age. It's simply an insupportable conclusion, and you won't find anyone who says it at this point.
This person asks what you think of Michael Crichton's book, State of Fear, which is a critique of environmentalism and lots of other things.
Well, I was disappointed in State of Fear, surprisingly enough. It's sort of a travesty, you know, and it did a tremendous amount of damage. I mean, you know, for the history of the planet will judge. But it is, you know, sort of a collection of random, you know, not facts. I wouldn't say they're facts. It's a wacky story. Probably some of you have read it. Maybe sort of a good thriller. And then it has like 20 pages of footnotes at the back. And that gives it the sense that it is you know, a piece of science, but it is absolutely, you know, not a piece of science, and climate scientist would be happy to tell you, you know, why it's not a piece of climate science. But I think it has fed into this basic desire, and I should really mention that. It's a lot easier to believe that global warming isn't taking place, because to believe it is taking place is to take the next step and say, okay, what are we going to do about it? And that is not easy. We all live very carbon-intensive lives. So I think it really played exactly into this, you know, to unfortunately be a pop psychologist, it played into a deep desire, especially in this country, to say global warming doesn't exist. But if you go almost anywhere else in the world, you know, that debate is just completely over. You go to Europe, there's just no more debate over things like this. And I don't know how the book did in Europe, but I'd be interested to know.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our distinguished guest is Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer for The New Yorker, and author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Could global warming be a civilization-ending process? What is the worst-case scenario?
I think many climate scientists would absolutely tell you it could be a civilization-ending proposition. And one of the reasons for this is this huge time lag in the system. And we are now, you know, there's these scenarios, they're called, you know, business as usual, because we just kind of trundle along as if nothing's happening, and we reach you know, doubled CO2 levels by 2050, and then we just keep on going, and we reach tripled CO2 levels by 2100. And the equilibrium warming associated with tripled CO2 levels is between 6 and 11 degrees Fahrenheit. And to give you a sense of the temperature difference involved there, during the last ice age, okay, when New York was under, you know, a mile of ice, global temperatures were only 10 degrees. Average global temperatures were only 10 degrees colder than they are right now. So that's the magnitude of the change that you're looking at. But you don't get that change out right away, so you can do the damage, and then you can keep on trundling along, and then future generations will have to deal with it. So I think that absolutely we are looking, you know, in the face of a potentially civilization, you know, wrecking problem if we don't take action. Now, you know, that is looking, you know, deep into the future, many decades from now. So it's hard to say, but certainly, what is the worst case scenario? The worst case scenario is you melt, you know, not only the Greenland ice sheet, you melt the West Antarctic ice sheet, and you get about 35 feet of sea level rise out of that. You get, you know, tremendous drought in what we now consider our major agricultural areas. You get a mass extinction event, which, you know, many people would argue is really already underway. You just wipe out a lot of the species that are presently, you know, co-inhabiting the Earth with us. And at a certain point, you wipe out species, you know, that we need to survive in our own food chain. And we don't know exactly what those are at this point, even to a certain extent. So those are the kind of worst-case scenarios that we're talking about.
There are a number of questions about the role of corporations in all of this. This question is, oil companies are excited about global warming and it will melt ice so there can be more drilling in certain areas in the north. What are the implications of this double whammy?
Well, you know, that just shows you, you know, the kind of wonderful, you know, ostrich-like attitude that we're taking to this. You know, really, the notion that there's going to be a boon to us from global warming. And you do sometimes hear this notion, you know, oh, there'll be winners, there'll be losers. But once again, that you know, ignores the sense that, you know, we live on one planet. We have, you know, only one planet. We only were given one. And you mess it up, and, you know, you don't get another shot at it. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what else to say to that. You know, burning more, you know, drilling for more oil and then burning it up is really, you know, absolutely the last thing we need to do at this point.
Have you encountered any enlightened corporate activity, corporations that are leading change and either adopting renewable energy practices or otherwise getting it?
Absolutely. I mean, corporate America, I think, you know, and I'm not really an expert on this, is ahead of the U.S. government on this issue. There are many corporations that have their own greenhouse gas reduction targets, absolute reductions, not reductions in what the Bush administration likes to call, you know, greenhouse gas intensity, which is just, you know, greenhouse gases per unit of economic output, but absolute reductions. You can go on the website of the Pew has a, you know, climate change group, and they have climate partners. There are many corporations, you know, that have plans. There are many corporations that are, and some of them are utilities. Synergy, for example, has which is a huge utility, a huge producer of greenhouse gases, is trying to reduce its greenhouse gases, among others. So there, you know, corporate America, to a certain extent, you know, sees the writing on the wall. And if you talk to people, they know that we are heading into a time when, you know, carbon will be a commodity, a limited commodity, a commodity that we have to, you know, expect limitations on. And many of them are preparing for it, and many of them are hoping to make money off of it. I mean, that is the actual, another sort of sad element to this, you could argue, which is that, you know, someone will create the new energy infrastructure for the world. And if we continue to sit on our hands, you know, it's going to be someone else. It could be the U.S., but right now it doesn't seem like it's going to be.
So are you saying that it looks like Europe or other Japan, for example, are, as they are with hybrid cars, are sort of
absolutely
ahead of us?
Right. I mean, you look at the U.S. auto industry, and you wonder if it will exist, you know, 20 years from now.
Is there anything being done to find another option to reflect the sun and stop heat from being absorbed into the ocean?
I'm sure there is, but it's really hard. I mean, the oceans are 70% of the planet, you know. So it's not easy to think of how you do that. But people are thinking of everything. I mean, this problem is so big that people are thinking of everything. People think of, you know, trying to send up, you know, when a volcano erupts, you get what are known as aerosols, and you get a temporary cooling effect from that. So you could try to artificially, you know, create that effect by, you know, dumping, I think it's sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, you know, from these huge planes, and then you'd, you know, get terrible acid rain, so you'd have that. So, I mean, unfortunately, you know, these kind of, you know, Dr. Strangelovian solutions have been discussed. But no one has come up with one that doesn't have, you know, pretty obvious ill side effects. Sulfuric acid. Exactly.
There are other questions here about other technological breakthroughs. Is there a silver bullet out there that somehow someone's going to create something that's going to turn this around that we can't yet foresee? And this is also drawing on comments that in the past, in the 70s, we had some biologists saying there was going to be overpopulation. It didn't come to pass. Could this be another case where we think it's worse than it's actually going to be based on previous examples of nihilism by certain academics?
You know, we can always hope. I certainly hope that's the case, but I don't think that there's, you know, a lot of, you know, I think that kind of, you know, let's just hope it's not so bad, that's, you know, seems like a pretty dangerous course to take, in my opinion. And waiting around for the, you know, techno fix, the silver bullet that's going to solve this, you know, also sounds like a pretty dangerous course to me. But, you know, there are certainly people out there looking for, you know, a new source of energy. And the only one, really, that I've ever heard of that, you know, really has the potential to transform the world is fusion. And no one is expecting, you know, to get fusion power out of fusion, you know, till the middle of this century at the very earliest, if we ever get it. And if we just, you know, continue along, as I said before, then, you know, we will have doubled CO2 by the middle of the century. And there's no turning that back, I should point out. You know, CO2 is a pretty long-lived gas. And to use a very rough figure, it has, you know, has sort of a half-life, let's say, of about 100 years. So once you put it up there, it's going to be there for 100 years. So even if you find the fix, once you've doubled CO2, you still have doubled CO2. So I think we really have to, you know, my own opinion would be we have to do everything that we can, and then we also have to be looking for new technologies, both of those things.
This question is about how the media covers global warming and says that the principles of balance and point-counterpoint in journalism actually has contributed to the perception that there's a debate about this when some people would argue, as you said, the debate's over. So talk a little bit about how journalists are covering this debate.
Well, I think that's a valid criticism, you know, I absolutely do. And I think that there was a pretty, you know, well-financed and well-thought-out campaign to make this a political issue as opposed to a purely scientific issue. And that was, you know, very smart. And when you think about it, it has, and it probably took a page, you know, directly from the tobacco industry. And the point was not to say, even to say that global warming doesn't exist. It was just simply to sow doubt. So you will always find people, and they're always the same suspects, you know, when any new finding comes out, well, you know, we're just not sure, sort of just poking holes in it. But I do think that is a dying art. That's the one thing I would say. And I do think that one thing that is changing is I do think the news coverage is changing. I don't think you see as much of that, you know, sort of, you know, I don't want to say it's he said, she said, it's sort of he said coverage. But I do think that it has persisted for far too long.
For a long time, ExxonMobil was one of the most skeptical oil companies. They were among the last to admit that global warming existed and that human activity contributed to it. So this one question about the role of ExxonMobil, and if they're finally coming around, does that mean that finally big oil is lowering their resistance?
Yes, I do. And ExxonMobil was one of the major funders of this, you know, climate, you know, skepticism, and these people who could often be found, you know, quoted or saying, you know, we're not sure, and, you know, they're op-ed little box ads in the Times, and So you don't see that anymore, and that is part of the reason. Well, I don't know which came first, you know, the chicken or the ExxonMobil, but you don't see ExxonMobil. You open the pages of any magazine today, and you will see every oil company tell you we're trying to reduce our carbon footprint. Now, are they really? I don't know. But they don't feel that it is any longer viable to say, you know, to sort of throw up smoke anymore. And I do think that even the oil companies have, you know, gotten off that argument. Now, unfortunately, to a certain extent, the damage has been done because you know, the head of ExxonMobil may no longer feel that way. You know, he didn't necessarily, you know, write a letter to all of his stockholders and to everyone in the country who read those original comments to get, you know, to tell them, oh, you know, debate's over. So there's a time lag there.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest is Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. I'm Greg Dalton. There's a number of questions here about some sort of dramatic public event or tipping point that could sort of galvanize the political process into taking action, some defining moment, whether that could be declaring polar bears as endangered or other things. So can you envision what might sort of shock the electorate or the citizenry into more aggressive action on global warming?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And, you know, to some extent, you know, one might have hoped that it was Katrina, which, you know, you can never say that any particular hurricane was caused by global warming, but you can say that, you know, it's in line with what we would expect from global warming. So we will see, you know, how the next hurricane season plays out. But I think, you know, to wait, unfortunately, I mean, that's the terrible problem. Our political system and all of us tend to react when things get bad. And not to repeat myself too often, but there's a time lag here. And once things get bad, that means that you've really already guaranteed that they're going to get worse. So we really have to be proactive. And our political system is not very good at being proactive. And I talked at some point during my reporting to John McCain, and he made the point, and I'm not quoting him directly, but, you know, paraphrasing him, we will win this debate. We will get action. The question is, how much damage will we do between now and then? And that is really the only question.
You mentioned corporations reducing their carbon footprint. Recently, the idea of carbon offsets has become popular, and the idea that people who drive SUVs can plant some trees or pay some, write a check for someone to plant their trees for them. Is that going to have any meaningful effect on carbon emissions?
Well, you know, driving an SUV and writing a check to someone who will plant trees or, you know, put up a wind turbine or some solar panels is, you know, better than, you know, driving an SUV and not giving a check to someone who's going to plant some trees or put up some wind turbines. It's not going to solve the problem, and it's probably not a way that you would want to try to solve the problem. Carbon offsets are, you know, sort of almost a theological debate, because what's an offset? It has to be something that wasn't already going to happen. That's the only way it really qualifies as an offset. And then you get into, you know, if you preserve that forest and it wasn't going to be cut down, it's not an offset. So you sort of have to wait, you know, till they have the chainsaws out, and then you throw yourself in front of it, and that is an offset. So it gets very, very complicated. But certainly, you know, I think that all things being equal, as I say, it's better to support, you know, clean energy facilities being built than to do absolutely nothing. How's that?
There's some couple of questions about the people, both in your book, and we'll get to one about yourself. In terms of, you travel to these remote regions, and people are actually being affected by this today, whereas for us sitting here in the United States, it's largely theoretical, perhaps not if you're in New Orleans. And are those people hopeful, or are they really pessimistic about the change that's affecting their life today?
Well, that's a really good question. They're pretty, you know, the ones I spoke to are pretty They're pretty sober about it. You know, they're mainly, at this point, the people who really see, you know, their way of life and their homes disappearing are a lot of native people in the Arctic. And they see, you know, they will tell you, well, at first it got warmer, and, you know, we thought not so bad. And now we look at it, and we see the changes are happening so fast, and we realize that our kids will not live here anymore. You know, our kids will no longer be able to live where we grew up and where our people have lived, you know, for thousands of years. So people are pretty downcast about it, I would say. I can't certainly speak for everyone, but the people I spoke to found it pretty scary, especially, as I say, the pace of change, which is hard for us in more temperate latitudes to appreciate. But when you have lived in a community, you know, where the sea ice comes in every year, and that is, you know, how you hunt and what your livelihoods depend on, and, you know, in the course of 10 years, you know, you see that there is no sea ice in the winter. That is just a horrific change up there.
What was your opinion, your thoughts about global warming before you started looking into research on these pieces?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think I was a person who was, you know, concerned. I read the papers, you know, just like everybody else. And I had read, you know, some of the previous books that came out, which painted a pretty compelling picture. But I was not terribly well informed. And what I found really absolutely the most sobering thing to learn is that there really is no, this is not like, you know, a speculative thing. This is just, as one of the guys that I interviewed on the Greenland Ice Sheet put it to me, this is just physics 101. You know, there's not something that, well, maybe we'll dodge this bullet. This is how, you know, the world works. This is how geophysics work, and we're not getting around this one. So we really have to face up to that fact. And I when I went into this, I was not aware myself of how, you know, absolutely certain some of these predictions were.
A couple people here in the audience said that reading your book was a galvanizing moment for them to get involved and take action on this issue. What for you was the moment where you said, I want to do this as my next project? Was there a moment that sort of said, this is something I have to do?
Well, it was just sort of, it sort of goes back to, you know, a question that was raised before. It was really as a journalist, and I was, you know, sort of a parent and a concerned citizen, and I also found myself perplexed by the coverage of the issue, and it sort of seemed to me, you know, that if it really were the biggest problem facing the planet, then that ought to be clear in the coverage, and if it wasn't, that ought to be clear in the coverage too. And so it was really sort of on the theory of, you know, if you're a journalist and you're perplexed by the coverage, then you do have an obligation to get out there and try to do something about it. So that was really what it was, and I have to confess it took me quite a long time, you know, to find a way to tell the story. It took years, basically. So I wouldn't say there was a galvanizing moment. It was much more of a long process of sort of self-education and talking to people all over the world.
We've reached the time in the program where we have time for just one last question, which is perfect for this question. Much of your audience here and on the radio will agree with your presentation about the perils of global warming. As your colleague at The New Yorker, Seymour Hersh, says, the trick is to convince governments and skeptics. So what is your best 30-second pitch or soundbite for how to convince skeptics that this is real?
Wow. If I knew the answer to that, you know, I think I'd win a Nobel Prize. I can only appeal to people on the behalf of their children and grandchildren to really consider the facts. That's really the best you can do. And I hope that people who are listening, who still consider themselves skeptics, will really do some research, because it's very hard once you've actually looked at the research to remain a skeptic.
Our thanks to Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker. And author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.